Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. My guest today is Nick Toriano. He is the executive director of Unite America, a group that works to philanthropically support nonpartisan election reform initiatives. He has a new book out. It's called The Primary Solution: Rescuing Our Democracy from the Fringes. This debate over the causes of America's political dysfunction is one of the favorite ones that I encounter on the podcast. Nick is obviously advancing the idea that our primary system and the empowerment of the fringes of the left and the right are one of the primary means beyond our country's inability to form a consensus on the big issues moving forward. There's a bunch of complicating factors that Nick and I get in during this conversation, but I think at a minimum level, he does a great job of getting the audience and ideally his readership to understand that oftentimes politicians might not actually just be corrupt. They might not actually just be bad faith. They may actually just be responding to the incentives promoted by the system as it works today. So examining the ways that we could or could not change that system to promote different outcomes are very, very interesting possibilities. Hope you all enjoy this conversation, and a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Nick Toriano, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to be with you, Marshall.
Yeah, great to be with you too. Okay, let's just start very basically and very obviously. Before we talk about the solution, I'd like you to start by just articulating what you see as the problem, quote unquote, that we're trying to fix in American politics.
The problem right now in American politics is that our governing institutions are not producing results that most Americans want to see on the issues that we care about. You know, rather than solving issues like our budget, climate, immigration, we get a whole bunch of partisan bickering, gridlock instead. And the division's gotten so bad that democracy itself is under threat now. Our buy-in around norms and values of free and fair elections, the rule of law, etc. So political extremism is preventing progress, also threatening this great American experiment that we have. That's the problem. The systemic reasoning for that is that our election system gives disproportionate influence and a megaphone to the political fringes in our country. And that leads to a vicious cycle of polarization that we're in today. So my argument in my book is not that we only have a politician problem. We have an incentive problem created by the way that we elect those politicians. And if we want to improve the people in office and what they actually do in office, and we need to improve the means by which we elect them, because they do not represent a true majority of Americans right now.
I'd love to hear an example of an issue where there's a clear majority, yet the incentives created by the party primary system prevent action from being taken.
I think we've seen this over the last couple decades on the issue of immigration, and most recently when a proposal, you know, failed in Congress that would have gotten strong bipartisan support. I use the example in the book of the bipartisan bill in the U.S. Senate that passed with close to 70 votes in 2013. It went over to the House in 2014. It combined things like border security with a path to legal status for undocumented Americans, with greater options for high-skilled labor to come to our country. So it was a compromise. And what wound up happening is that in the summer of 2014, Eric Cantor's House Majority Leader at the time expressed openness to dealing with these issues, maybe not the comprehensive bill, but different pieces in turn. And he wound up getting primaried by a more conservative candidate in his district. Initially, he wrote him off because Cantor was outspending him by orders of magnitude. But on election day, in a move that sort of shocked the political establishment, Cantor lost his primary. And the takeaway was that he was too open to working with Democrats on immigration reform. And so that bill never found its way to a vote in the U.S. House, even though if it did, it would have won likely a majority of the members, including Democrats and Republicans. But never got to a vote because Speaker Boehner wouldn't put it to the floor because a majority of Republicans of their own caucus wasn't supporting it, in part because they feared they'd be the next Eric Cantor and get primaried. So that's an example. And here we are 10 years later, and all these problems have gotten worse. We have a crisis on our border. We have millions of Dreamers, undocumented immigrants brought here as children, no fault of their own, in sort of legal limbo. That's an issue to your question that over 70% of Republicans, Democrats, independents agree they should have a path to legal status, but that problem still isn't solved today. And I think the primary system that we have is a good reason why. You have the Republican Party, which has gone down the road of build the wall. You have the Democratic Party that since Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez primaried Joe Crowley has gone down the road of abolish ICE, and we're debating bumper stickers, not actually debating policy solutions anymore.
You know what's interesting here? I'd love to hear your thoughts on, and this is kind of hard to answer because our political primary system is like a very recent invention, but I'm curious how you would think like the example or the thoughts of the founding fathers would, like what would their reaction be to the primary system? Because famously, especially during the early Federalist days, like there were, they did not believe there were going to be political parties. So you could have political parties, but the political parties could operate in the kind of smoke-filled room sense. Like there's lots of different approaches to way political parties could be organized. So given how alien the status quo is to that 1700s example, I'd just love to hear how you kind of think of the philosophical issues around party primaries.
Well, the founders wouldn't recognize the system that we have today. To your point, they didn't prescribe party primaries because they didn't want parties in the first place. So they didn't really contemplate how parties should nominate candidates. Of course, parties rose in the early days of the Republic, and the first means of candidate nomination was conventions and caucuses where the proverbial smoke-filled rooms of party bosses would choose the candidate. Famously, Boss Tweed, who ran the Tammany Hall political machine, said, "I don't care who does the electing as long as I get to do the nominating." They knew that even back then, primaries would be where most of the consequential decisions would be made. And that system, because of how much corruption existed within it, was what was overhauled in the progressive era 100 years ago that opened the primary process to voters participating directly. That was, relative to the status quo, a step forward. And what we've seen now 100 years later is that once again, that system has been sort of corrupted by entrenched interests, whether you think about them as being special interest groups that spend a lot of money to influence these races, or party activists, small groups of highly engaged voters that have kind of taken over the process. The primary system is not reflective of a true majority. And that gets at the other aspect of your question is, well, what are the sort of principles that the founders did lay out and how our democratic republic should operate? And one of those principles was majority rule and minority protection, right? The John Adams said the Congress should look like the American people as a portrait in miniature. And that's not what we have today. We have a Congress that reflects the wings of both parties, but totally does not give representation to the broad a center of our politics, whether that be on the left, right, or down the middle. And that's the essential challenge that we have today. I mean, we fought a revolution around the idea that government should have the consent of the governed. Congress doesn't have the consent of the governed today because 83% of our Congress is only elected by 8% of voters who participate in party primaries that dictate the outcome of those elections. So I don't think the founders would be happy with what they would see today in our system. Luckily, they gave us the tools to fix it. And that's what makes the solution that I write about so possible.
Yeah, I think what's interesting here is I think in many ways, we all have the worst case scenario when it came to the pre-party primary system. It's pretty obvious. Corruption, Boss Tweed, smoke-filled rooms. But, and I think you just kind of answered this question already, so we can move on from it. But your kind of point is the worst case scenario for party primary system is you just have a deep, deep, deep minority of people. We're not talking 40%. We're not talking 35%, 30%. We're talking sub 10% of the populace really making those decisions. That seems to be the worst case scenario there. So, okay, let's talk through a couple other things before we get to the particular solution. I think this conversation and the work you're doing is going to resonate with a lot of people who feel just a real sense of pessimism about our political system. But I think a lot of people would have a lot of different issues they would list out as being the cause of the malaise and lack of action you listed. So I'd be curious if you could kind of rank these issues I raised to you and compare them to the effect that party primaries have on the system. So for example, there are a lot of people who think that we need term limits. And they're like, well, look, like these people get elected and they stay too long. We have a gerontocracy problem. How does the gerontocracy, actually, we should separate those. Let's start first with term limits relative to party primaries, which is a bigger determinant of bad outcomes in DC or across the country, because party primaries are a state issue as well too.
Yeah, I think the reason why we see our Congress getting older and older and staying in office longer and longer is a reflection that we don't have truly competitive elections in which most voters can hold their leaders accountable. I mean, how else is it that Congress has an approval rating under 20%, but 90% of members get reelected? It's that most November elections are an illusion of choice, right? If you're an incumbent, once you win your first election in a party primary, and if you don't represent, like most don't, a competitive seat, that seat is pretty much yours unless you do something pretty egregious, either in a sort of political scandal type way or in not towing the party line. If you work across the aisle and attract the ire of your base, you may get primaried. So most rational politicians are able to navigate those issues reasonably well and easily. It's just that it works out well for them. It just doesn't work out well for the country in the sense that that produces a pretty unproductive Congress in terms of able to solving the problems that we care about. So the blunt force instrument to see more turnover, for lack of a better word, in Congress is term limits, which 90%+ of people would support. I think the better answer to the same problem is simply having more competitive elections to actually give voters more choices, more viable choices of who represents them. So if they're not satisfied with the way that their current leader is doing, they have viable alternatives. And that's what this solution is designed to provide.
Okay, so next issue would be money and politics. Money and politics relative to party primaries in terms of the problems that we're looking at.
Also a problem. I mean, there's a corrupting influence of money in politics in terms of where the sources of funding are coming from and how the motivations of those who are giving map on to the politicians in office. And it's just also a problem in terms of how much time our leaders are spending raising money than actually doing their jobs. The question is what to do about that. And what we've seen in the past is it's sort of like plugging, you know, one hole on a sinking ship and seeing that water come out of a different hole. It is hard to address, especially with the constitutional protections to free speech, the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. There are groups certainly working on a pathway of trying to overturn Citizens United, American Promise being one of those organizations. So I don't think these ideas are mutually exclusive. We should do all of the above, address the money and politics issue. But my sense is that the primary system is a more fundamental challenge that impacts governing incentives, and also, as I'm sure we'll get to, a more viable one to address in the near term because it does not require an act of Congress or constitutional amendment to create. But in many ways, these problems are interrelated because the people who we need in office to tackle these other challenges and who are supportive of reform can't get there into office right now because of the current system. So that's just to say, you know, if we're able to tackle the primary problem, I think it'll give us more leverage to tackle some of the other problems, including money and politics.
So last one before we get into the specifics of your solution. I wonder what you think about the, I don't want to say tinkering around the edges because that's kind of pejorative, but the idea of, okay, so let's have open party primaries. Let's make it so that, you know, like when I voted in Texas a few weeks ago, like I could decide, did I want to vote in the Republican primary? Did I want to vote in the Democratic primary? And I could just push the button. It was super, super easy. I think that's a means of kind of making it so that as a voter, there was just a straightforward way to handle that. What do you think about the results of changing the system to make it so that your average unengaged non-party registrant voter could actually participate still?
It's an important step forward. I mean, it is unconscionable right now that in 2024 in 22 states, close to 24 million Americans cannot participate in the primaries for president or Congress, even when those are the primaries that will effectively determine the outcome before November. This includes, a majority of young people. It includes close to half of veterans. So why are we telling the people who are the future of our country, those who fought for the country, that they don't get to have a voice in it? That's wrong. And so opening primaries to allow all voters to vote is really table stakes to trying to fix the system. There are additional and more powerful reforms that we can do, but that doesn't preclude us from at least ensuring that every voter, you know, regardless of party, can participate in taxpayer-funded elections, right? These aren't just private organizations running their own nominating processes. These are elections that the government is running that we're all paying for. And so therefore, every voter ought to have a ability to participate.
So yeah, let's get into the solution part then. Like, what are you advocating for? Separate from just critiquing this party status quo, obviously.
Yes. No, the solution is pretty straightforward. If the problem is party primaries and the fact that they disenfranchise voters and distort outcomes, the solution is to abolish party primaries and to replace them with nonpartisan primaries in which every eligible voter can vote for any candidate, regardless of party, and where the top finishers would go to the general election, where whoever earns a true majority of the vote gets elected. And by upholding those two principles, what the system is designed to do, the solution is designed to do, is produce elected officials who represent a majority and responsive to a majority. And the more states in which we can win this reform will mean that we'll have more leaders in Congress who are willing to put country over party to do the right thing and to do what we elect them to do and what we hire them to do, which is not to exaggerate our differences and score political points and to keep us angry at each other, but to actually narrow our differences, to be able to find common ground and to solve the common challenges that we face as Americans. That's the promise that abolishing party primaries has in our democracy today.
And what's interesting here, when you kind of say abolish party primaries, I think a lot of listeners could imagine, you know, Congress passing a law abolishing party primaries, but we do have these laboratories of democracy. So there have been a variety of states that have effectively done this already. I think California is an example. Could you talk about some of those examples and what have been the lessons and takeaways from those early efforts to change the system?
Yeah, there have been five states so far that either for state or federal office, they've gone away from party primaries. And a state like Louisiana, which did this in the 1970s, they didn't replace it with anything. They have a general election. Everyone can run in. If no candidate gets a majority of the vote, then there's a runoff between the top two vote getters. And what we've seen in Louisiana is that it's a state with traditionally the second least polarized state legislature in the country, and a state in which, despite being a conservative state in the Deep South, you can get a moderate Democrat like John Bel Edwards elected governor. He served two terms, was just left office recently. But he championed issues that were popular among a majority of voters. He was a pro-life, pro-gun, moderate Democrat who also championed Medicaid expansion. The first day in office, he used federal government resources under the Affordable Care Act to give hundreds of thousands of Louisianans access to health care for the first time. What a difference that made in their lives. And again, not like other states that turned away the funding that the government was offering just for political reasons. So whether you agree with that or not, the point is that a majority of Louisianans supported that issue. They weren't getting it. The system of no party primaries in Louisiana allowed someone to come along to run for office, get majority support, and do what the public wanted. And that's something that we see in other states that have enacted these reforms. In California, for example, in 2010, it was Governor Schwarzenegger that campaigned for an initiative that was referred to the ballot from the legislature that would replace the state's party primaries with top two nonpartisan primaries. And that got to the ballot because there was a courageous state legislator who said every voter should be able to vote from whoever they want, and that leader should represent a majority. And he used his vote that was needed for the state budget to negotiate a deal to give this option to Californians, and they overwhelmingly voted in favor of it. So that's how reform has come to be. It looks a bit different in each state in terms of how it's enacted, but the impact is similar. It creates a government that is more functional, more representative of the people.
I'm curious, if we're thinking about these different states who've enacted these reforms, What do you think is the sweet spot in terms of like the ideological makeup of the state? So for example, I think the worst case scenario you could imagine is you're in a hyper blue part of California and you're focused on like a congressional or state Senate race or state house. And there are just so many Democrats that you end up having a situation where like the general election is always just like two Democrats versus each other, or in a super red state, be two Republicans versus one another. And you just don't really see a real contrast of views and vision. And in a weird way, it kind of makes, it turns it, especially during a low turnout election, the general election just ends up replicating the old party primary process versus like, let's say a purple state where you could say like, hey, like instead of having a radical on the left and a radical on the right, you have two more centrist candidates on the left and right. So yeah, talk about like the real like ideological mix that would make the outcomes people are looking for, you think.
Well, to use your example, I think in California, for example, if it is a safe blue district that is always going to elect a Democrat, voters will have more power in a general election in which it's between two Democrats on their ballot. It's always good to elect one. So which flavor of Democrat do you want? Or in a safe red district, two Republicans competing. Now, some people might say, well, that means for a lot of people, by the time November rolls around, they don't really get to express their true preference because they might not be a Democrat or might not be a Republican in those districts, which is why others have innovated on top of the California system to say, instead of advancing just two candidates to the general election, advance four. And that top four system is what Alaska adopted for the first time in 2020, used it for the first time in 2022. And the results were rather extraordinary because in the statewide elections, voters, a majority of whom are independent in Alaska, elected a conservative Republican governor, a moderate Republican senator, and a moderate Democrat for U.S. House. So a different flavor of candidates elected by the same statewide electorate. Why? Because voters were given the opportunity to make nuanced decisions on who they preferred to lead. And they weren't red or blue. It was the variation of perspectives that voters were able to choose between for those offices. So the system doesn't advantage one party or another. It does really empower voters to make these decisions.
How do you enact these reforms without making everything too confusing? Because something I'd heard, you know, when I talked to some people on the right who are unhappy with the Alaska reforms because it's pretty clearly aimed at like moderating politics in a way that those people on the right don't really agree with, they just kind of point out, hey, look, like, four candidates, that's way more complicated in a way that would probably maybe like reduce turnout. Like, how do you respond to the sort of like, we're just turning too many toggles and flipping too many switches and knobs. Let's just stick with something straightforward and work on turning out more voters in the first place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The only people who I've heard describe the Alaska system as confusing are those that, you know, don't represent a majority of voters and are looking for an argument to critique the system. You know, our exit polling showed over 85% of people actually called the system simple. 99.9% of ballots cast under it were cast accurately and counted. So I don't think it really holds much weight to say in a primary, choose your favorite. That's what you currently do, except you have more choice this time. And in a general election, you can still vote the old way if you want to, or now you have the option of ranking your preference. And when you do what you do in every other aspect of your life. You say, this is my preference, and if it's not available, here's my backup. So I think it's pretty simple and straightforward. And more importantly, it gives all voters a chance to cast a meaningful ballot. I think so often we look at the health of democracy just in terms of the number of people who participate, who show up in November, without really asking, well, are they casting a vote that matters? And in most cases today, the answer is it doesn't, because these elections are foregone conclusions because districts are so lopsided for one side or the other. In Alaska, we saw a close to 60% increase in the number of voters who cast ballots in elections that weren't predetermined by party affiliation alone. So this reform is simple, and it's about giving a lot more power to the voters to decide who gets to represent them.
So is the plan just to continue on a state level, expanding the number of states that actually have open party primaries? Is that the plan here?
Yeah, the plan is a state-by-state movement to create pressure for national change. I mean, that's how other social movements have won in the past. You can think about, I write about in the book, a whole example of the marriage equality movement, where it was state by state ballot initiatives, legislation. There was a litigation strategy. There was a, that ultimately led to a Supreme Court decision. And there was a congressional strategy that ultimately led to a bill passing Congress just 2 years ago, enshrining marriage equality in our country, as well as a cultural shift. Think about like public opinion on this issue over the last 20 years. The cultural shift was a result of this campaign being run at the local, state, federal level over the course of 20 years. I think that's the analog to what the election reform movement is doing today. The good news is that we can make a pretty transformative impact in Congress if we win just another half dozen states over the next 3 years, because in every state where Alaska-style reforms are passed, it liberates both U.S. senators and the U.S. representatives from that state from the grips of party primaries and allows them to represent all of their constituents. So in a narrowly divided Congress where you can have a fulcrum of Democrats and Republicans, perhaps a few independents as well, working together, that can create momentum around bipartisan legislation to make progress on the issues that we care about. And that's the theory of change of what we're working on. And to your point before, it's not about moderating or electing more centrists necessarily. This is about a system that can elect people who could be true representatives of the states or districts they represent. In many places in California, they're going to look a lot more progressive. In Louisiana, they're going to look a lot more conservative. But the thing they have in common is that they're answering to a majority of people who elect them, not just the 8% of their most active party base.
I want to really double click on what you just said there, because it seems obvious, but I've kind of encountered, there are two different ways to get where you've gotten on the party primary reform, in the sense that you've identified the problem as a lack of representation of majority will. Sometimes folks who are in the reform crowd will just look at the Alaska example and say, see, we don't have Sarah Palin. She's an extremist. We should avoid a policy that leads to extremists in office. But I think focusing instead on not identifying the problem necessarily as Sarah Palin's election, but just the fact that, hey, look, at an empirical level, we've designed a system that for a variety of pretty straightforward reasons doesn't engage huge portions of the populace in elections. And if we're in this moment of populism, it's much, much harder for people on the far right and far left who are skeptical of this type of reform to argue against that. So I think that's just like a really exciting reframe from the way I've thought about the way people advocate for this that I hope folks could really take away from.
Yeah, I appreciate your underscoring that, because had Sarah Palin been elected under the system in Alaska, and you said, did the system work or not? I would say the system worked. That's who a majority of Alaskans voted for. And by the way, the Sarah Palin that we would see governing in Congress under this system would look a bit differently than under the old system, because like any politician, she would know what would be required to get reelected. The whole name of the game is to try and align what it takes to get reelected with what is serving the majority and ultimately producing effective outcomes on the issues that we care about. That's what elections are designed to do, discern and translate majority will. That's the essential challenge in our election system today, is that it is failing to do that. And a result of that is actually opening the door to left and right-wing populism that is undermining democracy itself, because this is the situation in which demagogues can come along and say, the system is failing, I alone can fix it. Other countries have gone down that road and it doesn't look pretty.
You're interesting in this category because you yourself have actually run for office. Obviously, you were running, you know, as an independent, so I don't think you were measuring the drapes in the traditional way when you were thinking about like your role in office. But like, just given the fact that you are a politically inclined person who's coming to this space, I'd actually love for you to kind of talk about the degree to which you believe politicians have set ideologies, set desires, set policies, versus, for example, the way that they operate when the systems change. I think you may have noticed this, but there at the State of the Union a few weeks back, there was that Republican member who was wearing like the bow tie and the like ridiculous Joe Yes. Biden t-shirt. But something people pointed out is that 2 years ago, before his district was redrawn, he was like very concertedly like shaking hands with Joe Biden, because back then his district was much more moderate. So him just being a Republican who could play with Democrats edged better. Once his district became much more right-leaning, it was easy for him to kind of show up as a literal clown. So I think that's a kind of interesting example of like the phenomenon I'm asking you about. But like, I guess what I'm really asking you, I worry that when we kind of talk about politicians being purely governed by incentives, it gets cynical a little too quickly in a way that like undermines, I think, excitement about politics. So like, what would you basically say is the band? So for example, you could change that guy's district a lot. I don't suspect he'd come out in favor of universal healthcare just that next week. There is like a limit on it. So like, how far do you think that band of reasonableness is?
And I think this is such a great question. Maybe the best question I've gotten so far about this book. And I think it's intriguing to ask because there is a spectrum of the balance between someone's principles, identity, ideology, and the political incentives of the election system that they are elected under, which is to say, we should be careful about what our expectations are. We can change these rules, but if we have the exact same people in office, we're only going to see a marginal difference. And so it actually does take a lot more to change what we see today in terms of bringing people into the public service that otherwise have written it off and to succeed under the system, whereas they otherwise might not, in terms of the groups that are recruiting and supporting them. And on the other end of the spectrum, it is also to say that under the current system, if we were to take a magic wand and replace all 535 members of Congress, but elect them under the current rules, that we also shouldn't expect too much of a change either, right? So it exists on both ends. But what I would say is that one grounded way of looking at this is passing these reforms, the impact will be that the fear of getting primaried will no longer be the gating item to why something does not get done that might otherwise. It won't be the reason why something does, but it won't be the reason why it doesn't anymore. And that creates the opportunity for leaders who have an inclination to govern in a more pragmatic way to actually do so. Because my experience in getting to know and working with elected officials is that when you're in office, you can really rationalize over time more and more, gosh, it's important that I stay here because if I don't, someone worse is going to come along. And in order to stay here, I have to start to make these compromises. I mean, and I say this as someone who's only been part of one party in the past, and it was the Republican Party before I became an independent. How do you get 147 Republicans on January 6th objecting to the electoral vote under a free and fair election with no basis? That's a red line that they crossed. And I think one of the reasons is they made a whole bunch of rationalizations about why that was important, because if they didn't and Trump was on his revenge tour trying to primary them, well, they wouldn't be there to do the other things that they came to Washington to do. And that's a very dangerous path to go down. But that's what people do in our current system. Now, I'll extend that same example a little bit further to say there were 10 Republicans who exercised extraordinary political leadership and courage to vote to impeach the former president for inciting an insurrection. The only ones to have run again and won again came from states that got rid of their party primaries, came from states where they could make their case to a majority of their voters, not just the party base. So I think that's a perfect illustration about, you know, getting right to your question of that band, because it exemplified the latitude that leaders will take if they know that they can stand on principle and not be punished for it, or at least take a reasonable risk in doing so.
As a pretty moderate person politically, I'm just inherently so sympathetic to this critique of the political system that I really struggle to kind of devil's advocate or kind of offer just like a counter to it. So here's a question. I'll make you do my work for me. On your media tour, you've been a lot of places. Like, what's the best pushback you've received to this idea?
I don't know that it's actually happened on this tour, but in the course of
it, or in general, right? This is your day job, right? So, like, what's the best pushback you received?
You know, I'm being honest because I'm trying to answer your question as technically accurate as I can. The best pushback I've received is we're living in a new era in which there's higher levels of distrust in elections than ever before, in which political opportunists will try to spin things to their own benefit or sow doubt if they don't win. You know, the whole principle around if you don't get the most votes, you should concede no longer applies. And so I think the best critique is, what is the tension in changing the electoral system in this moment when there's already such distrust out there about elections? And we've seen this play out in Alaska. There's a 2-week period that the state has to wait to receive all the mail ballots from overseas and military voters. And the ranked choice tabulation, the State Division of Elections will not run until all the ballots are in. So it can cause a scenario in which someone has the most first place votes on election night. And then 2 weeks later, the person who may have been in second or third place winds up winning. That is a situation that is ripe for those that don't want to uphold political norms and values of our democracy can use to undermine confidence in the system even further. And so I think that's a fair critique. It's something that I'm worried about. And there's ways that we can mitigate that in the way that elections are held and administered, that process, the transparency around it, and the voter education. And that was a role that we took seriously at United America, having been an organization that supported the adoption of this reform, was after voters approved it, not packing our bags and going home, but continuing to support the groups that were out there educating voters about this change and what it means for them.
Yeah, I also want to just call out your articulation of that because it's really important. It seems to me that if you're a Secretary of State, you cannot be lackadaisical about delays, processing issues, lines being too long, because when you're in a high trust society, there's clearly going to be a degree of comfort or leeway you could have with those situations. But very clearly in certain states and certain election types, there's just going to be very little tolerance for that. And that leads to the dangers you're describing. So that's very well said. Yeah. Okay. So here is the last question that I'd love you to really speak about. So critically, like this is in your bio, like when you ran in 2014, you were actually the youngest candidate in the cycle. So I think you could think a lot about generational change and how different generations think about political parties in different ways. And something that I kind of think about, that I get excited about, like I live in the state of Texas, and my politics are complicated, so I'm not just saying this to just kind of be pro-Democratic or anti-Republican, but I get really depressed sometimes when I see these intense party primaries where people are basically saying like, oh, like Texas is like a red state. Texas is conservative. Like to be Texan means you have a certain specific type of politics that can't look any different than this very specific image. And it seems to me that those arguments, the more and more I talk to people like you and the more of these issues start to resonate, are going to get weaker and weaker and weaker just because at a generational level, even Texans who are conservative, if you actually just like lay down their specific viewpoints and their policy expectations, they just aren't going to be comfortable with a politics that is aimed at, well, you're an R, you have a big R on your chest, or you have a big C on your chest, and that's your defining identity. So I think that's like an encouraging note that I've just picked up the more and more and more you like speak with these things. Like I, you know, like when we do the big breaking points tours with Crystal and Sagar, I talk to these people. We did an Atlanta show, and these people would say the most like conservative things. I'm like, oh, so like you're a Republican. They're like, no, I'm not a Republican. Like, what are you talking about? Even though like in my DC sense, they're very clearly Republicans, but that just seems to me to be like a very good thing and why there's a ripe opportunity for your movement, because there's just like a deep, deep discomfort with labels and identity and the need to separate those from your policy preferences. So can you kind of close with maybe something optimistic that you've noticed in these spaces over the past decade that kind of rhymes with my thought of like, okay, wow, this might not appeal to a baby boomer whose vision is them joining the Young Democrats when they're 18 in the 60s versus a young person who isn't comfortable with labels in the same way.
Why I'm optimistic is all of our polling on reform issues state by state show dramatically high levels of support among millennials, but especially among Gen Z. And so I think as this generation comes of age, they're not going to accept an electoral system, you know, that was designed when people were going to the polls in horse and buggy, right? They're going to demand something better. We've disrupted every other industry and virtually every other aspect of society with new technology. We've made it more personal, more nuanced, more choice. There's more competition. For better or worse, there's more instant gratification. So our election system, I think, needs to evolve with the times of where society is at now. The quote that I use to open the book is my favorite quote from Thomas Jefferson. And it's actually in one of the walls in the Jefferson Memorial that is a place I like to visit when I'm in DC to draw some inspiration. But he said, and to paraphrase a bit, we might as well make a man wear a coat as he did as a boy when we expect future generations to live under the same laws as their ancestors. That with the progress of time, as we learn things, as things progress, so too should our institutions. And that's a founding father a couple hundred years ago, right? So that was the ethos in which they designed our system of government. And I'm optimistic because I think as young voters come of age, they're going to take the power that is in their own hands once they discover it, as I did when I ran for office at the age of 24, to say, hey, yes, the system is broken, but that same system gives us the tools to fix it, whether that looks like running for office, whether that looks like trying to get more young people engaged in politics, or whether that looks like reimagining the way that we elect our leaders. And that's why I'm not in despair right now, despite a bitterly divisive presidential election, the erosion of what we're seeing in terms of our democracy. No doubt these are big threats. We're going through a tough time, but look at the course of our history. We have done so before. We've fought a civil war. We've gone through the civil rights era in our country and assassinations in the 1960s. This isn't anything new. We can persevere and we have the tools to do so. The thing that I think is so important, though, is that we don't lose sight of our own agency, that we don't say it's gotten so bad, there's nothing we can do about it. In fact, there's a lot. And the states that have already adopted these reforms prove it. Last note is that this year in 2024, six states are pursuing these reforms: Colorado, Nevada, Montana, Idaho, South Dakota, Oregon, Arizona. This is the most robust year for election reform that we've seen in the modern era. It can be an inflection point. And whether you live in those states or know people in those states, our opportunity to win this year is an opportunity to say, we can reclaim our democracy from the fringes, from a political establishment that's no longer serving us.
Very well said. Troy, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thanks, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.